Mountain crest to mountain crest, from canyons to the clouds and into the cosmos, we are pumping wattage high and low, streaming worldwide on the internet and keeping you company tonight. It's live every Saturday, the place to relax and hang out. I'm your host, Joshua P. Warren, and this is Speaking of Strange, giving you the latest and discussing the weirdest. We have assembled the finest team of reporters and the most intriguing guests, and that's why we are your favorite hub Saturday nights. You know, during the break, I stepped outside here in Western North Carolina. That chill is in the air. I could smell the wood smoke in the distance. It is officially fall, and the Halloween season is upon us. In a tough economy, it's the perfect time to hop in your car and start exploring creepy places in your own state. And if you're near North Carolina, well, you're in luck. The Tar Heel State is jam-packed with goodies. And your ultimate guide is the brand new book by Kayla Ambrose. It's called Ghost Hunting North Carolina. Her website is ghosthuntingnorthcarolina.com. And we're going to go on a bit of a journey here through our state's most interesting and spooky places. Kayla Ambrose, welcome to Speaking of Strange.
Hi, Joshua. Thanks so much for having me.
Oh, it's a great pleasure, and what perfect timing, because this must have been wonderful fun for you just to get in your car and drive around this state and have access to all of these mysterious places, huh?
It really was. I feel like an unofficial haunted history ambassador now for North Carolina after seeing the coast to the mountains and everything in between. It was a great adventure.
Well, that's wonderful because, you know, I'm a native of North Carolina. And are you from this state originally, or what's your
name? I'm not. I'm from Louisiana originally. Oh. I've been here 15 years.
Well, Louisiana is another good one.
yes, it is.
So you have plenty of background in these amazing stories. And it's wonderful to see that you have done such a fine job of compiling them together in a nice, clear manner, so that truly, if a person just wants to pick up one book and start maybe around, you know, Asheville, what many people call the Sedona of the South, and then just, you know, head west, there will just be one spot after another that is noteworthy. And I guess what we should do here is, before we get into locations, let me ask you some about the general approach that you took. How did you put this book together?
Absolutely. First, Joshua, I want to say, though, thank you for what you just said. I am a big fan of you and your work, and I consider you Mr. Haunted North Carolina. So hearing you say that about the book really means a lot, because I know you love and have spent so much of your lifetime dedicated to the haunted history here and everything that goes bump in the night. So thank you for that.
Wonderful. My pleasure. Thank you.
Sure. As far as the book, with this particular book, it's part of America's Haunted Road Trip, and they're working on a ghost hunting book for each state. There are several criteria in mind. The first one is it has to be publicly accessible. So there's a lot of other haunted places here in North Carolina that I just couldn't cover in the book, because this book is meant to put friends and family, or if you're a paranormal researcher, get in the car with your team and be able to go to these sites where you can get in and do some research or find out more about the history and have some fun and see if you see a ghost yourself. So that was the first criteria. The second was, what is the history behind each place? Is there a long-term history? Did something happen there? And usually with ghosts, it's something not too pleasant that happened over time. And are people talking about it? Is there a haunted history that seems to last for a long time where people have experiences? And then the third was a little different with me compared to some of the other authors, as I was born this way, as I say it, being intuitive and seeing ghosts and being empathic. So the third aspect was I wrote about what I experienced at these places. If I saw something, if I encountered something, and something happened. So between those, I went from a list to 100, down to the 25 chapters and then 5 other addendums in the book, covering the ones where had the best history, the best places to go investigate, and the ones that gave me a tingle or two along the way.
Excellent. And that is one of the things that
is so often overlooked. The human body is really the first great ghost meter, because the way that we know to go to these places and bring in all of our technical stuff and take measurements is because, you know, somebody has had an experience there. Someone says, I have seen this, I have felt this, and it's amazing when over the years you find that sometimes there are people who are disconnected from each other and they have the same experience, and so that adds some kind of objectivity to what's occurring. And of course, in the table of contents, you started in East Carolina and then went, or maybe the editor did, whatever. It starts in East Carolina and then it goes west, but we'll do the opposite tonight since we're in Asheville. We'll kind of start in the west and work our way toward the east. So in the area of western North Carolina here, you talk, for one thing, about the Grove Park Inn, a place we know very well, and I was actually the first person who was hired to do an official investigation of the Pink Lady after she had been kept secret by the resort for decades. They just weren't sure how it would be taken publicly, and I was actually the first person who announced that room 545 was the place I thought would be perhaps most active. So it's frustrating that we can't determine exactly who the Pink Lady was, but, you know, in my book Haunted Asheville, I talked a lot about some of the elderly folks I interviewed who worked there, who knew generally about what had happened. When you were at Grove Park, what did you pick up and perceive?
Well, interestingly, Grove Park actually happened to me way before I ever knew I would write this book. Back in 1998, some friends of ours here, and I live in the Piedmont area of North Carolina, they invited us to go to Grove Park just for a getaway. And we went and stayed at the main inn. That was the place they recommended, and I think there was a special at the time. Didn't know anything about the Grove Park, which had just only been in North Carolina a small time. So we stayed on the Palm Court floor, and we had our son with us, who was young at the time. And he was ill that night, woke us up in the middle of the night, not feeling well. So I gave him his medicine and went out to sit in the Palm Court Pavilion area and was just holding him and trying to comfort him, waiting for him to feel better. As I was and his head was resting against me, I felt a chill. I was getting colder. I started tensing up. Why didn't I bring my blanket out there with me? It was really cold. And as I looked up, I saw the form of a woman standing there next to us. And I've seen ghosts before, so it wasn't a complete shock, but I didn't know the Grove Park was haunted. And I stayed calm and didn't really say anything because I was more concerned about my son at the time, who was not feeling well. And he raised up at the same time feeling cold and looked over and said, Mommy, what does that lady want? Why is she here? So at that point, the jig was up. He was seeing her too. And we looked at her and she stayed there, not very long, under a minute, but stayed with us. Didn't seem interested in speaking to me, as some ghosts do, just was there really in concern for my son. Anyway, I went back to the room, and my son was jumping up and down the bed, Daddy, Daddy, we saw a ghost. And but he still wasn't feeling well, so we had to check out early in the morning to take him back home. When we went to check out, I went to the front desk and said, tell me about your ghost. I saw this ghost, and they described her, and they said, oh, you saw her. And they talked about a doctor that had been there not too long ago that had also reported her and said, you know, she seems to be drawn to children, almost like she has an affinity for them and wants to care for them. And the Grove Park itself is a place I personally would like to haunt if I was going to haunt anywhere. It's one of my favorite places in the world.
Sure.
And I go back often. I love just the fun of the Grove Park and the beauty and the spa and all of that. And I've gone back so many other times and sat in that court just saying, hey, come talk to me. I'm here. She's never come back. It was only that one time with my son. So I believe what they say, that she seems to have an affinity with children. And it makes me think, like, I need to bring another child with me next time I go and see if she'll come talk. But that's how I found out about the haunted Pink Lady, as she's called. And I came back talking about it. And it wasn't too long after that, I don't think, that someone actually gave me a copy of your book and said, hey, this guy's writing about this. You need to hear about it. So I remember your book and all that. I think it was wonderful. And the Grove Park now, of course, talks about it all the time, and other ghosts there as well.
Yeah, and in fact, in a few minutes, we'll take our first break. And when we come back from that break, I want to talk about something horrible that a lot of people don't know about, the mass murder in Germantown, Charlie Lawson's mass murder. Horrible event. But before we do that, something that I really enjoyed in this book that surprised me was that you have a section about ghosts at the Biltmore House. And the Biltmore House has traditionally been still pretty reserved about discussing the activity there. It's well known. There are lots of rumors, and I've known lots of people who work there who say there are ghosts, but you actually published about it. Did you get any official word from them, or how did you do your research at the Biltmore House?
I didn't get official permission for them. That's definitely the case. But I published my findings there and what I was told by several employees who only agreed to talk to me about it if I promised to keep them anonymous. And I thought the story was so important that I really wanted to share it. I've toured the Biltmore House many times, and the experiences I write about there, I experienced myself being down in the kitchen area, down by the empty swimming pool where voices are heard. As an intuitive and someone who senses spirit, I've had my own experiences. So I kept it more about that. I did want to speak more with the Biltmore House about it, but their official policy is that they don't speak about it. And I did share the stories with those, but promised to keep them anonymous from the employees there that were willing to share, because a lot of them really do want to talk about it. A lot of them have the experiences. And I felt it was important to share their stories and to tell their tales as well as the tales of the ghosts in this book, and in a way to be a voice for them and to speak for them.
So before we go to this break, what did you find was the central ghostly figure at the Biltmore House?
Well, I think it's Mr. Vanderbilt himself. He's seen a lot in that first area when you first come in, the Vanderbilt there, when you're touring. And it's kind of a round, octagon-shaped area. And there's a lot of energy felt there where they had so many parties. And in the library as well, where he would appear often. And his wife would continue to speak to him after he died. Where I felt the most energy, though, during my tours, were in the kitchen area, and that appeared to me to be kitchen staff, an older lady who maybe at the time kind of ran the roost down there of what happened in the kitchen. She was very strong and not very happy, very surly and angry, and she seems to be affecting most of the energy when you go toward those areas where the servants worked in the kitchen area and around the swimming pool as well. So I'd say it's those two that are the strongest, Mr. Vanderbilt and this unnamed lady who's a little hostile, not really wanting to talk. She kind of shushes you and tells you to move along. And I'm not sure that she's too happy about all the people walking around touring in there.
Sure. All right. Well, when we come back, we'll talk some about this really, you know, horrible incident. It occurred, believe it or not, for those of you who've never heard this, on Christmas Day, December 25th of 1929, a tobacco farmer actually shot and bludgeoned his entire family to death. And there was a book written quite a few years ago about this called White Christmas, Bloody Christmas. And so when we come back, we'll talk to Kayla about that incident and then, you know, continue making our way across the state. She's got so many great stories in here. There's no way we're going to be able to come close to touching them all, but we'll touch some representatives from each region. Her new book is called Ghost Hunting North Carolina, and there is a link there at speakingofstrange.com to the site where you can learn more, or simply enough, go to ghosthuntingnorthcarolina.com, and North Carolina is all spelled out. I'm Joshua P. Warren. You're listening to the show where the unusual becomes usual. It's Speaking of Strange, and we'll be right back.
Linville Mountain, where the bear and the catamount range, there a strange ghostly light can be seen every night, which no scientist or hunter can explain. In the mountains of North Carolina near Linville, there exists a strange phenomenon called the Brown Mountain Light. On a clear night, this light will appear and move about in a ghost-like manner on the mountaintop and down in the valley. This light has been observed since the early days of the covered wagon, and to this day, no one can explain its mystery. Even scientists who come from various parts of the world can offer no solution. Uncle Fate Wiseman, who spent his entire 80 years in these mountains, used to tell this story, which to me could be as true as any other tale related, about the Brown Mountain Light. In the days of the old covered wagon, when they camped on the flat for the night, With the stars growing dim on the old high gorge rim, they would watch for that brown mountain light. High on the mountain, then down in the canyon below, it shines like the crown of an angel, and fades as the mist comes and goes. Night after night until dawn, a faithful old slave come back from the grave. He's searching, searching, searching for his master who's long, long gone. Long years ago, a southern planter came hunting in this wild land alone. And here, so they say, the hunter lost his way and never returned to his own. His trusty old slave brought a lantern and searched, but in vain, day and night. Now the old slave is gone, but his spirit wanders on, and the old lantern still casts his light. High on the mountain, and down in the canyon below, it shines like the crown of an angel, and fades as the mist comes and goes. Night after night until dawn, a faithful old slave come back from the grave. He's searching, searching, searching for his master's long, long.
A truly classic song here in the mountains of Western North Carolina, The Ballad of the Brown Mountain Light by Tommy Fail. And, gosh, you know, that has really represented how many people feel about that odd phenomenon for generations now. Welcome back to Speaking of Strange. I am Joshua P. Warren, talking right now with the author of Your Haunted Road Trip Guide Across the Tar Heel State, Ghost Hunting North Carolina, Kayla Ambrose. And Kayla, do you pronounce your first name Kayla?
Yes, that's good.
Okay, very good. Wanted to make sure. Now, did you get an opportunity to see the Brown Mountain Lights in your research?
I have. And you know what was so fascinating to me, beyond going there to that mile marker and looking for them and watching, is talking to so many other people that go and wait to look at the Brown Mountain Lights or have a story. Everywhere I went, someone had a story. What was most fascinating to me is the stories are all a little bit different, what people see. And it reminds me of a sci-fi show called Babylon 5 that used to be on, when there was a character on there named Kosh who always wore a suit. And when he took his suit off, everyone saw a different representation of him according to their beliefs. And some saw him as an angel, some saw him as a deity. It was just all these different things. Loved that in that show. And when I talked to people about the Brown Mountain Lights, they had similar stories. Some had physical sensations. Some saw the lights moving quickly and blinking. Some saw them in different shapes, the colors. Everything was different, almost as each person had some kind of personal experience with it. And I found that fascinating.
That's wonderful to hear you say that, because I think that also is one of the things so fantastic about that phenomenon, that we are ultimately talking about mysterious, enigmatic lights on a mountain, but whether you talk to astronomers or physicists or geologists or chemists or spiritualists or ufologists, they all sort of put a different spin on it from that individual's particular perspective. And that sort of represents why that the paranormal, I think, is so fascinating in general. And, of course, you can look at something like the wonders of the Brown Mountain Lights, and it's a very positive thing. But then there are some places in this state that just really sort of send a chill down your spine. And as I mentioned before the break, one of those is this area where on Christmas Day of 1929, this man named Charlie Lawson just massacred his family. What can you tell us about that incident and some of the stories now it has spawned?
I think it might be the saddest thing I wrote about in the book and investigating. It was so horrific. And right before Christmas, he wasn't a very wealthy man. I think he was a tobacco farmer. And he took his family into town and bought them all new clothes and had their portrait taken right before the holidays there. And that was pretty expensive to do back then. And then on Christmas Day, he shot and killed his whole family. And the children were aware of what was happening. The children, some of them ran trying to get away. He had to hunt them down and shoot them. Some of them, he wasn't sure if they were completely dead, so he bludgeoned them to death. For some reason, he spared his older son. He sent his older son away on an errand. And while the older son was gone, he killed his wife and children, and then finally himself, or at least that's what the report is. And there's a lot of rumors about it, about why. And the book that you mentioned talks about some of those rumors, the White Christmas, Bloody Christmas. And supposedly there was a family friend who was friends with the oldest daughter named Marie. And there was a talk at the time that he had been in an incestual relationship with her and that she may have been pregnant. So that may have spawned what happened. But the truth died with the family. No one really knows for sure. That's a legend, and the family, some of them dispute it. It's just an extremely sad story.
And so are there ghosts now that are seen around that property?
There are. You know, it was so macabre afterwards that the brother, after this happened, actually kept the house open as a tourist attraction for a while, which I thought was so macabre. And, of course, there were a lot of people reporting energy and ghosts. But eventually the house was torn down. And one of the most interesting things I found out was they took the wood from that house being torn down and they built a covered bridge nearby. And people describe this bridge as just always just seeing ghosts of children, just hearing terrible screams and sounds and groans. And it seems that it transferred in the wood from the house into this bridge. And then a lot of people report as well the ghost of the family where they're buried in the nearby cemetery, that they're seen there a lot as well since the home and the property itself is gone. But I've found that a lot with wood. Even there were a lot of shipwrecks where the wood would wash ashore and people would take this wood and reuse it. They built a lot of porches in East Carolina on some of the houses there along the ocean, and then their houses would become haunted, like the ghosts from these shipwrecks were attached to the wood and would stay with the wood. So whether you built a porch or a bridge, the ghost came with it.
Now,
better beware.
Yeah, really. And of course, we are so used to houses, old wooden houses, having creaky staircases. One of the most famous ghost photos is one from England called the Brown Lady of Raynham Hall. And she is seen traveling often up and down an old staircase in 1936. A photographer for a magazine supposedly inadvertently, you know, captured a shot of her. Well, we have a brown lady here in central North Carolina as well, don't we?
We do.
And what's the story there?
Well, it's amazing to me, and also I found so interesting how many ladies that are all over. And it seems to be that they love. There's the lady in black that's seen over in Fayetteville. There's the brown lady at the college. And that's interesting, too, because that college, they're a very Christian college. They really didn't want to talk about that too much. But she's been seen so often. And I believe it's Chowan University is how you spell it. I still learn a lot about North Carolina and some of the dialect here. But it's a very Christian college. But she's been seen so much by so many, they don't even dispute it anymore. They actually have a festival to celebrate it, and they celebrate her. And she's seen in a lot of the buildings. There's, especially around fall, seems to be the time that's the most popular for her. And she seems to love the fall leaves, and she'll blow them into the dorms and the areas there for people to know that she's there. And for a long time, it was really popular where they would do the legend, and they'd have a huge festival, and they would actually pick a girl each year to dress up as the brown lady. They'd walk with her over to the cemetery where she was supposedly laid to rest, trying to help her find her peace and her rest. And they still continue to acknowledge it. In some part, I don't think they do as big of a festival anymore. But I always find that interesting because so many people, and I'm sure you've come across this, Joshua, in North Carolina, there's a lot of varying beliefs here according to religious beliefs and cultural beliefs, if there are ghosts at all. I was doing some book signings today where people would come up just to tell me they don't believe in ghosts. And so there's such a difference. But when you have a place like that, a university that is very Christian-based, not really dealing with this type of thing, and yet everyone there is saying, okay, we see her, there's something going on here, it just kind of reaffirms that it's not really a religious thing. It's just spirit. It's just life. It goes on, and some people don't move over as peacefully. they stay here or part of them stays here, depending on which type of ghost it is. And that's what I found so fascinating with that. It's almost like she's there to kind of tell that tale and to show people that and maybe break them free from some thinking that they might have had previously.
That's a great point, because I've always felt that most religions are based on the idea of a spiritual realm, and so they should embrace the idea of these apparitions, these specters. And of course, in this particular case, according to your book, the story is that her loved one left to fight in the Civil War, and when he didn't come back, she died of a broken heart. So that is in Murfreesboro, North Carolina. We're going to take another break. When we come back, we'll talk about one of the more notorious places in the central part of this state, the Devil's Tramping Ground. And it's also even more enigmatic because it's on private property. And, of course, you heard Kayla say that she tried to stick with places that were more accessible. So we'll find out what her take is on the Devil's Tramping Ground when we come back. I'm Joshua P. Warren. You're listening to the program where we dig into the amazing, the remarkable, the extraordinary, the spooky, the downright weird, keeping you company every Saturday night.
Little Red Riding Hood. Hey there, Little Red Riding Hood. You sure are looking good. You're everything a big bad wolf could want. Listen to me, Little Red Riding Hood. I don't think little big girl should go walking in these spooky old
Joshua P. Warren. Thanks for taking a little ride with us tonight across the Tar Heel State from these mountains, some of the oldest in the world, all the way down to the coast, the Outer Banks. We're talking about it all with Kayla Ambrose. And there are some very spooky woods and very remote places between each end of this state that some people might want to avoid at night. You can learn about them all in her book, Ghost Hunting North Carolina. There is a link at speakingofstrange.com, or you can go directly to her site to learn more. And that website is, simply enough, ghosthuntingnorthcarolina.com. One of the more notorious places in this state, Kayla, is the Devil's Tramping Ground in Siler City. What can you tell us about that?
Well, you're right. I broke my own rule there, talking about a place that you can't trespass. And one of the things I put here in the book in the back is travel information so that you can go see all of these places as well in the book, the addresses, the websites, where to go. And I did have to put in this one that it is private property and no trespass. So my official version is there's no trespassing, and I did no trespassing.
Sure.
Now, I had to include it because the stories are over 300 years old, and people have talked about this forever as the Devil's Tramping Ground. I talked to so many people who went there as teenagers who are now 60 years old and talk about what they did there and what they experienced. Basically, it's a tramping ground. It's a circle. It's over 40 feet in diameter, and nothing ever grows there. And we're talking, it's in the middle of the woods. There are ivy and vines and trees and bushes, everything growing around it. You really have to work to get there. But the circle itself remains empty. And so many people have stories of putting something in the circle, walking away for a minute, coming back, and it's tossed out of the circle. There were people who told me they tried to sleep in the circle at night, woke up and found themselves that they had been moved out of the circle. The legends go on and on. Now, the oldest legends say that this circle was made by the devil and that he paced in a circle. He would walk round and round making this circle as he thought of new ways to do terrible things here on the earth. And that so he would pace on and on until he made this. Other people say that it's something actually to do with Native Americans that once lived there, that it was an area where they did certain rituals and things, and whatever happened there changed the soil where nothing will grow. There's been quite a few scientific groups that have gone to study it and taken soil samples. None of them can determine why nothing grows there, but they all say that something is different in the soil, and it's completely different than the soil around it where everything is growing. Other people more recently were telling me they think it was an ancient alien landing site and that there was activity like that here in North Carolina and that there are circles of these types several around the world and that this is one of them and that what was done there with that, and I'm no scientist, but whatever was done with the aircraft there, something changed the soil. Everyone's got a story. Everyone's got an experience. Not really easy to get to these days. It seems like a lot of the people in their 50s and 60s back then, it was just kind of a place they would go and have a party like teens could do and hang out there and scare each other, and they could get there, but now it's really protected. But it's one of the oldest legends, I think, in North Carolina, that along with the Brown Mountain Lights, like you mentioned. And it was just so important, I had to stick it in the book. I couldn't make it an official chapter, but I wrote and gave all the information I had about it there for others to know, because I think it's really important.
Oh, sure. One of the most influential authors of North Carolina ghost lore was John Hardin, and he wrote Tar Heel Ghost, and one of his books was actually called The Devil's Tramping Ground and Other Stories, et cetera, et cetera. So it's you'd think they'd want to charge admission to it in this day and age, in this economy, and make some extra bucks. And, you know, maybe they'll want to do that. But sticking with, I guess, the theme of trying to make it across the state here, because there is just so much in this book, Ghost Hunting North Carolina. Let's talk about one of the most famous names associated with this state, Blackbeard. What did you discover about ghosts and stories related to him, Blackbeard the Pirate?
I discovered, surprisingly, having grown up hearing about Blackbeard and how terrible he was, I ended up kind of having a crush on him. I heard a lot of stories that he wasn't as bad as people said, and that he did more things to intimidate people. There were so many stories about him growing his hair long and putting fuses under his hat. He would light the fuses to scare people, look like fire coming out of them, and he would say, "I'm the devil," and just to scare them. And he did do some dastardly things as a pirate. But I learned so much more about his life, of how the Navy at that time, they would use pirates when they were at war. They would use them to blockade and do things. And then when they didn't want the pirates anymore, they would just cut them off. Yet they had no other things that they could do, and they needed money, so they would continue to pirate. So like so much of history, there's the history written by the victors, and then when you dig deeper, there's the history that tells both sides and goes much more. Of course, Blackbeard, I think, is reported everywhere on the coast there of North Carolina. I was in Charleston last weekend giving a talk there, and everyone wanted to talk about Blackbeard when he blockaded Charleston in that area. So he's infamous wherever you go around here. At the end, when he was in the last fight, he was shot multiple times. He was stabbed. He still kept fighting. Eventually, they caught him, and the captain cut his head off and hung it on the sail of the boat to say, "I got him." And his body was reportedly tossed in the ocean at that time. Now, there are so many reports. Some see him with his head. Some see him without. They see him walking up and down the coast everywhere, looking reportedly for his treasure. And what I found most interesting in my research is now that a team of students and archaeologists at East Carolina University have found what they believe pretty much is his ship, the Queen Anne's Revenge. The sightings of him are now through the roof, all around, even more than they have been in such a long time, almost as if he feels like we're getting closer to finding out the truth about everything, touching things on his ship, and he wants to see what we're doing, and maybe his treasure is next, that we'll find that. But there were so many stories where people would say he lived here or there. I talk about all the different cities that had a part of it, but it seems like when he did go inland, he would take a rowboat, go further in the inner bank part of North Carolina, stay at places like the Hammock House, that he went there just for some R&R to recuperate. And was a pirate and did all those things too, but was a man too that just really enjoyed North Carolina. And perhaps if you walk along the beaches there and ask for him, he'll come tell you the story himself.
So now, being that his head was such a trophy, do we know what happened to his head? Is it in someone's collection now, or was it supposedly tossed into the ocean with his body?
It was supposedly kept at the time by the captain, but it seems to have disappeared from there. And there's several people claiming that they have his skull, and several societies and orders claim to have it as well. But no one's presented it for DNA evidence, so I don't know. They don't really have the rest of his body either, so there's no way to really compare it DNA. But there's as many stories about what happened to his head as the rest of his body.
Now, how would you like to walk into my museum and see the skull of Blackbeard sitting right there?
Do you have it? Is it true?
Sure, yeah. It's a little small, and it has some long incisors. It looks a little like a squirrel skull, but no. I really would. I'll put a bounty out there right now. If anybody has the real skull of Blackbeard, or, you know, whatever happens to remain, contact me. Let me know. I'd love nothing more than to add such a macabre display to my collection. And when we come back from this break, we're only going to have a few minutes left with Kayla. I want to ask her about something that we touched on a bit earlier, the lady in black. So we've talked about the pink lady. We've talked about the brown lady. Let's get a little bit of detail on the lady in black, and then we'll also ask Kayla about what she has planned for the rest of this month. Maybe there will be an opportunity for you to meet her at very least. We hope that you will get a copy of this wonderful book. And one thing I like about Kayla's book in particular is that before the show, I was passing this book around the studio, and I was saying, you know, I can tell she really cared about getting her facts right. It's a very accurate book, and you see so many sloppy books that are done, and hers is detailed and factual enough that I think you can rely on the information in here. So, again, it's called Ghost Hunting North Carolina. And you could literally just take, you know, a month and just get in your car, and if you wanted to, and just drive from place to place and have your own adventure, or you could spread it out. But either way, ghosthuntingnorthcarolina.com will give you access to this brand new book. I'm Joshua P. Warren. We'll be right back with Kayla here on Speaking of Strange. From the heart of the Blue Ridge Mountains, Asheville, North Carolina, this is Speaking of Strange, and I am Joshua P. Warren. Coming up next hour, yes, the Dark 30 Hour, when we talk about some of the more outrageous and controversial news happening lately. Oh, and we have a stack of it, let me tell you. Right now, wrapping up the conversation with Kayla Ambrose about her new book, Ghost Hunting North Carolina. It's part of America's Haunted Road Trip series. And before we talk about the lady in black, Kayla, what would you like to tell listeners who would like to learn more about you and your work this fall?
I'm traveling North Carolina again, and once for the research here and now to do book signings and talk about Ghost Hunting North Carolina. Everything's on ghosthuntingnorthcarolina.com, like you mentioned, and I'll be in Asheville next month. I'll be in Winston-Salem, Greensboro, Wilmington. I'm traveling all across the state. So love to talk about this and come out and see me. Find the place that's closest to you and the date that's there. I'll be on the road between now and Halloween everywhere.
Do you recall where you are going to be in Asheville?
I believe I'm going to be at Books and Breadboard over on All Souls Crescent Street, I think it is.
Oh, Biltmore Village. Okay, perfect
place.
Hey, maybe we can work something out to have you at the museum as well, you know, while you're
in town.
Yeah, we'll talk about that.
Great.
Okay, fantastic. And, you know, what you'll find probably is that you'll have a volume 2 out before you know it. You'll get so many stories now that people will read this book and come and seek you out. So tell us some about the Lady in Black around Fayetteville there.
You're so right. There's so many women that were haunting here in North Carolina in their various colors. In Fayetteville, there's the Fayetteville Women's Club, which was built in 1797. It's a beautiful building. And people have reported seeing a ghost there, a lady dressed in black, for as long as the Civil War, I think, way back at that time. She appears on the stairs, and a lot of people at first thought her to be Margaret Sanford, was a lady who lived in the house, and she lived there before the Civil War, and I believe during part of it as well. They thought at first it might be her, that she was haunting the place. But later on, more reports started to come in, and the lady that was seen was much younger. And the story then came that they thought it was a young lady who lived there at the time during the Civil War, and she was in love with a soldier. And it's reported that there's a hidden tunnel there in the house, a secret tunnel, that led to the Cape Fear River. And the lady was there with her love, the soldier, and he heard that Sherman's army was marching and getting closer to Fayetteville. So he went through the secret tunnel to go help his men and protect Fayetteville. And from what I've heard and what the history says, things didn't go well there for the soldiers, and none of them really returned. But she kept a vigil and would wait every day, night after night, and she would wait by the door or the secret part there for the tunnel for him to come back. And again, she's another that they talk about dying from a broken heart. It seemed to happen a lot back then, that people just would kind of give up hope. If they couldn't have their love, they had nothing, and they would literally waste away. And at that time, it was very common to wear all black, a sense of mourning when you lost family members. And it was presumed that she wore black, understanding at some part that he was probably gone, but a tiny part of her didn't want to give up hope. And so it's said that when she passed away, that she still stayed there, and that she appears on the stairs and other parts of the house. And she's reportedly touched the back of some people who are there in the house, whether they're visiting, and to get them to turn around. And when they do, she has kind of a pleading look on her face, like, "Or is it you?" Like she's still looking for him. So it's interesting. You know, there's energy imprints of ghost stories where, like we know about in Gettysburg, where the Civil War is played over and over, and they don't really interact with other people. They're just repeating it. Some people see her like an energy imprint where she's just there waiting. But yeah, we have the other stories with people saying she appears to interact with them, touching them and asking them to turn around so she can see their face and see if it's her lost love. And that's one of the things I found in North Carolina in doing this book and the history, is how much the Civil War really affected the state, how much damage it caused, how much loves were lost, how much pain and sorrow, whether I was at some of the most haunted plantations or the forts there along the coast. To stories like this. North Carolina suffered so much during the Civil War, and the ghosts, many of them are still here, and I wanted to share their stories that way and hopefully give them some peace and some understanding as well.
Well, you're so right about that, and there is much to still be written about that period in our history that so many people just don't know about, but you definitely have done a great service to the history and the current pop culture, if you will, in this state by writing this book, Ghost Hunting North Carolina. I sincerely think it's a great book. I hope everybody listening will get a copy of it, and it's easy to do if you just follow the link there through speakingofstrange.com, or simply enough, go to ghosthuntingnorthcarolina.com. Please, you know, keep us informed of all your upcoming work, Kayla, and hey, good job. Thank you so much for being on the program tonight.
My pleasure. Thanks so much, Joshua. And can I say thanks for all that you do. Appreciate all your work here that you do in North Carolina and around the world. It's so needed. It's so important. And what you do is wonderful.
Well, that means a lot to me. And thank you for that. There you have it, my friends. Kayla Ambrose, a little virtual ghost tour across the state. And you know, you could just keep drawing that line right on out to the east till you hit around the island of Bermuda, the top point of the Bermuda Triangle. There was some kind of a strange alignment here. The whole world's getting pretty bizarre, though, as you'll see in the Dark 30 hour coming up after this. I'm Joshua P. Warren. You're listening to Speaking of Strange.